Hi, welcome to episode 10 of the Hansen Hour. We're in double digits. Yay! I think that's really, really exciting, and I'm really looking forward to continuing on this crazy journey that we're all on together. I feel like I don't know where it's going, but I know that it's really enjoyable for all of us. So it's bringing me a lot of joy, and I hope that it is bringing the same to you. We have Scott Hogan on today. Scott is a bass player, and he was the bass player with Hansen from January 1997. He did the 98 Elbertine tour and the 2000 This Time Around tour, which is just so fun. He's played on the Tulsa, Tokyo, Middle of Nowhere, Live at Fillmore, the Jack Frost soundtrack, which we all remember. Gosh, I remember that. So he's, you know, he's a great, is repertoire the right word? Rap sheet, really? Rap sheet, that's probably better. You know, he was really there for this era that we are unpacking at the moment, and had some really beautiful stories, insights, things to share. And it's just incredible being in the same energy as other people that were there. And I feel like for me, and I'm thinking this is the same for you too, it's like you can almost be transported back into that little time and be a part of it somewhat. So I really hope that you enjoy this episode. Scott is incredibly genuine. He also is incredibly gracious and full of gratitude, which is something that I always have resonated with. His gratitude for the experience, and in particular to the way he talks about Walker Hansen and the connection that he had with him is really, really nice too. So yeah, enjoy it. Reach out to Scott if you know you want to connect. He's around and still doing amazing things. So I'll see you soon.
We can fill that in later. All right, Scott. So I always like to start with a few icebreakers. Can you let me know what's your favorite Hansen song to play on bass?
I would say one of my favorites was Speechless off the Middle of Nowhere record. And I always had a really good time playing Hand in Hand. That's a really well-written tune. It's a beautifully crafted tune, and it was a lot of fun to play that one too.
That's incredible. I love that song, and I don't hear that song come up enough. So that's like such a good memory unlocked. It is a really, really epic song, that one. I love it.
You know what song else? There's that song Weird is really beautiful. I always had a good time playing that one. I think there was a really nice performance of that on Conan O'Brien. Just something about the vibe. I think everybody really captured it that day. And that's a really well-written tune. It's really interesting and really pretty.
Yeah. And it's so funny because just before I hit record, I was saying to you, I'm going to stick to exactly what I've written here and let's not go off on a tangent, but I've just had this thought pop up. So being that the band don't have an actual bass player in the band, right? So we've got keys, drums, and guitar. How were those bass parts written in? Do you know, like, have any backstory on that?
I know for like Speechless, they got this amazing bass player, session cat from LA named Abraham Laboriel. And I think he played on Look at You as well off of Middle of Nowhere. And his bass playing was like exceptional. I think they had some of the producers play Steve Lerone. I'm pretty sure he played bass on, on a lot of the recordings as well. But yeah, they used a lot of session musicians in LA to fill out the bass parts.
Yeah, and to write as well. Like, if you're Hanson in a studio, because I don't know much about songwriting, do you have to write a specific part for the bass, or does the bass just sort of fit in with the rhythm?
I think just working between the producers and they had top-notch songwriting people that were helping out. Mark Hudson was great. And I think between the producer, usually will kind of shape where the bass line goes and stuff like that within the tune.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. What about a favorite Hanson memory, like all-time favorite Hanson memory?
I mean, the Grammys were really special. That was a really special event. Got to meet a lot of really cool people in the backstage area. And I remember looking out into the audience and just seeing like Sting and Pavarotti in the audience. And I was just, it was really thrilling. And the backstage area, I got to hang out with Nathan East, who's one of my favorite bass players too. And the Frasier was hosting it. And I think he's sober now, but at the time he might have been drinking and he was yelling a lot at the interns for, you know, cursing at them and getting kind of rowdy. So it was a really interesting gig because it was just like everywhere you looked, there was somebody that was, you know, yeah, it was fun.
I can't imagine. It's funny, when we had Ravi on, he said that he didn't get to go to the Grammys, and it was supposed to be that particular show for you guys was supposed to be a celebration of all your hard work and where you've got to. Is that your memory of it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was rough because, like, yeah, Ravi and Peter Schwartz, I was really close to Peter Schwartz too. Peter Schwartz was like an MD at the time. And, you know, their vocals, the harmonies that they were singing were incredible. And Peter Schwartz had worked with like David Bowie and Chaka Khan. I think he actually did some stuff with Tina Turner, who passed today too. But he sort of worked to get us in shape. And Peter Schwartz was really amazing. And I still, you know, the nice thing about social media is I still see what he's up to. He's out in LA and we had a couple conversations and it's really nice. You know, I know there's bad aspects to social media, but it is really nice to see people that you haven't seen in a long time, you know, and see what they're doing. You know, it's kind of fun.
I agree. And I think, especially with stuff like this, like I wouldn't have been able to contact you or contact hardly anyone with not out social media. So I think it has its good points.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So can you just go back to the start? How did you come to play bass for Hanson? What's the story behind it?
Okay. So I was taking lessons. I was playing locally since I was 15, in bars and clubs. My parents were really cool. And they, you know, instead of getting like a regular job, I was just, you know, they would drop me off at somebody's house and at a musician's house. And I would go with them. It was before I could drive. And sometimes I'd work clubs until like 2 a.m. So they were pretty lenient with me because, you know, I bet some parents wouldn't be too approving of that. But my mother started taking me into New York City for lessons with a bass player named John Patitucci, who was a really well-known jazz bass player. They had something in the city called, they had a drummers collective and they had a bass collective. And I wasn't taking lessons with him that long, but Mercury Records contacted John Patitucci to see if he had any students that he would recommend to play bass for Hanson. And I came home from school one day, I guess it was like December of 96. And it was a phone call from one of the A&R reps at Mercury Records. And they didn't really give me a whole lot of information. They sort of put out there what I would be getting paid and if I was interested. And they would send us, you know, I had to send in some headshots and a demo of me playing, you know, I had recordings playing with other bands in the area. So that was kind of like the audition. It wasn't like I didn't go in to audition with them. It was more I sent an audition tape and a bunch of photos to Mercury Records. And I guess by January of 97, right at the beginning of the year, I found out that I got the gig. And then they sent, I think they sent like a cassette in the mail with, it was the record, Middle of Nowhere. And I listened to the whole record. I really thought I was really blown away. You know, finding out that they were as young as they were is really amazing, that they were able to sing like that and play like that. And I think they gave me a list of tunes to learn. I think in the beginning it was Thinking of You, Umbop, A Minute Without You, Where's the Love, and I Will Come to You. And then at the end of January, I think it was the last week of January, I met Ravi and Peter at the airport, and we flew out to Oklahoma, and they rented a theater, and we hashed out those tunes for a week, and then flew down to Miami to play for like Walmart's and Sam Goody's to see if they were gonna put the CD out there. But yeah, my first impression of them was that like they had a wicked sense of humor. Like they're always keeping you laughing, but then when they really needed to crunch down and be serious about the music, they were. And I think you got to give a lot of credit to their parents too, because, you know, there's kind of like, you know, child stars, I think it's really hard. A lot of them end up going down the wrong road. And Walker and Diana really did an amazing job of just keeping them grounded and stable and out of the treacherous parts of the business.
Yeah. There's another two things I want to circle back to. I'll just speak on this and then I want to ask you another question. When I interviewed Steve yesterday, he said that there wasn't ever a time when Walker and Diana weren't in the room with them, and he had to beg them to, he wanted just an hour alone with them, and they were really uncomfortable, they didn't want it to happen, but in the end they agreed to it, but not very, like, you know, they weren't really keen on it, and that's the sort of level of support. And I agree, like, giving credit to them, they made sure that they didn't go down any track.
Yeah.
So were they around quite a bit, right, obviously, when you were working there as well? The parents were very involved.
They were extremely involved, yeah. And they were just, they knew when to kind of tell them to calm down and get focused. And, you know, there were little sibling rivalries and stuff during some of the rehearsals and everything. And Walker would just really, you know, he was just really stationary. I think Diana was more the one that they got the musical talent from. And I think she had really harnessed their vocal abilities, because they sang to sing in harmony like that, it's a lot of training. And they did it so naturally that I think she was the one where the musical talent came from. But Walker was definitely like keeping the whole thing stable. He was a rock, and he was a really amazing person. Yeah, he was really impressive. Both of them, you know, it was just, you know, they really worked together as a team, and it was just a very strong family unit. And I think that stopped them from falling into some of those crazy pitfalls.
It's incredible. So how old are you? Because you mentioned you came home from school and there was a call from Mercury. So what's your age range at this
time? I'm 44. At the time when I just turned 18, I was a senior in high school.
Wow.
And a lot of the time spent on the road was sort of like I was doing that instead of going to college. But I did, you know, I actually missed way too much school to even graduate high school. But they cut me some slack, and I was constantly going in and like making up homework and stuff like that. It was a little bit of a tumult. It was a little bit, there was a lot going on, you know.
Yeah. Do you think they wanted, I mean, and P.S. That would have been an awesome summer for you. Do you think that they wanted players of a particular age bracket? Like they were looking for that sort of younger, and obviously they called your bass teacher and said, like, have you got any students? They were sort of to put that package together. They were after people that had that same sort of appeal, like the more younger.
Yeah, they wanted younger people, yeah. I mean, I sort of fit in. They wanted a certain look, and they wanted somebody younger, yeah. So it just sort of fell in my lap that way, and I got really lucky and really grateful for that time of my life. It sort of enabled me to keep doing music because it's a bit of a tough business at times. Doing that gig so early set me up financially where I was able to keep doing it even through weather, some of the harder times and stuff, you know.
Incredible. Yeah, absolutely. And to see that, like, it really can be done, you know, it happened so early straight off the bat.
Yeah, you never know. None of us really ever know what's gonna happen, you know.
So what about, can you talk to us a little bit about the shows you were actually involved in at the time? We mentioned the Grammys, but it looks like you were there like pretty extensively. I know you came to Australia, right, as well?
Yeah, Australia was amazing. Yeah. It was really fun. You know, I meant to ask you too, there was like this, I remember it was a really long flight. I think it was 18 hours. We landed the next morning, we were having breakfast, and there was like, what struck me was like the animals were so different. Like what they would call a possum in Australia is totally different than the possum that we have here. Yeah. There was this, some of the bird calls were really interesting. You know, I asked, this one bird just kept going all morning. It was this really involved melody and really beautiful. And, you know, I asked the waitress what kind of bird it was. She said it was a nightingale, but I mean it was in the morning, so
a magpie, I reckon.
It was,
you have to google a magpie, and I reckon it could be. I don't think we have nightingales anyway.
Nightingales come out in the evening too, around here. Yeah, this was okay. Really early in the morning it was, but yeah, it was just and some of the trees, like the roots came out of the tree to get the water. Around here, like the roots are in the bottom of the tree. And it was just a really interesting country. Yeah, it was amazing. We did the Sydney Bridge climb, which was really fun.
That's right. I remember the photo. So actually, let's go back to that 97-2000 sort of era. So all around America, did you do their promo for like Paramus Park Mall and anything like that?
Yeah, you know, it was funny because you were asking me about like, were there any scary moments or stuff that they had? Mm-hmm. And that Paramus Park Mall, I remember specifically, that was an acoustic show that they did by themselves, but they came, we got together with them the next day at a rehearsal studio in Manhattan, and they were like really freaked out by the way, you know, by how that went down, because I don't think there was enough mm-hmm. security. And people kind of rushed the stage, and Zach kind of like barely made it out of there.
Yeah.
So that was like a little bit of a scary moment for them. And it was right when they hit, and they were like, wow, are all people from New Jersey that crazy? They're, you know, it was kind of funny. I mean, it was a little bit of a, I remember them coming, they were a little bit rattled by that the next day, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Because Ravi had stories about them or you guys being placed sort of at particular positions on the stage because people were making like kidnapping threats and stuff because it was all just getting too much. Do you remember anything like that?
I mean, they definitely needed security and I don't know if I really remember that. Maybe they didn't really talk about that with me or something.
Yeah.
Maybe that was more something that they'd spoken to Ravi. Ravi was a little bit older than me at that time. Mm. But yeah, that Paramus thing really was a difficult situation for them to get through. I think that was sort of a scary situation for them.
Yeah, Absolutely.
I mean, there were times where we would be in their in a vehicle with them, and we'd be leaving a show, and the vehicle would just be getting knocked back and forth. And I remember one time the window was open and somebody grabbed my shirt. But that was like a standard thing that, you know, the vehicle would just be getting shaken back and forth if it was like a bus or something like that.
Yeah. Because I think that they were really underprepared for how many people were going to show up to that.
Yes.
So I would hope that as time went along, it got a little bit better in terms of security and what you guys could expect when you showed up places.
Yeah, it got a lot better. But
I think it still happens now. Like Zach talks about like people trying to get into his hotel room and paying like security guards like X amount of money and stuff. Like, I think old habits die hard, right? Like,
Wow. People
are still trying to. It's not like, I don't think anyone's rocking the bus, but, you know, there are people that still try and. I don't know what it is, just to be that close, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, you also may have had a little something to do with introducing the boys to their wives.
So, you know, one of the more humorous things about it is that, you know, all these, the roadies and stuff, they always end up having funny nicknames. And the first two roadies we had were Turk and Flappy. And Zach was really young. Zach used to call Flappy Flapjack Falafel Head. And, you know, he liked it. You know, it was cute. It was fun. And some of the other roadies were named Yoda. And I don't know why Yoda got that nickname, but I always thought that was a really strange nickname to give somebody. And there was Romeo and Kahuna and JV. So all the roadies had nicknames. And Romeo kind of got his nickname because he was out. Oh. He was out with Kiss, and he was a Romeo. So. We were doing a gig in Atlanta, and there were all these models that went on the stage before the Hansons played, and Romeo was like, he came over to me and he was like, listen, you know, the Hansons have to stay on the bus all the time with their parents, and they're not able to go out and socialize as much, and you know. I really want to do something special for him. So he organized having all the models. He's like, I'm going to get all the models to come on our bus. And I want your, you know, cause I used to hang out with them. We were a little bit closer in age. So we would play soccer, sometimes basketball, and, you know, we'd play games and stuff like that before the shows and everything. So he's like, you're closest to their age. So go to their bus and ask Walker if they can come on. If they can come on our bus, and I'll have all the models in the front of the bus, and they can have a meet and greet. So, yeah. So I went over, and I was, you know, it was late. It was late at night. It was after the gig, and I went over to walk the Hanson's bus, and I was like, "Oh, can the guys come out and hang out? You know, just want to hang out for a little bit." So it was really, I was really proud of this moment. So we went back on our bus, And I just kind of put up my hand and I was like, you know, this is the meet and greet. And I looked back and I'll never forget the expressions on their face because they were like, they were totally shocked and surprised and just very excited. And I just started laughing immediately and ran to the back of the bus. And, you know, Romeo had the door cracked open a little bit so we could watch the meet and greet. But yeah, so that they ended up... They ended up marrying some of the models from Atlanta.
That's incredible. That is actually a really, really, really cool story. So what were the models doing there in the first place? Like,
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I think it was Macy's models.
Okay.
Yeah, it was, and they were modeling clothing before the gig. It was like the stage was, there were about 20 models. For Macy's.
Yeah.
And then we went on after them.
Okay, so was it a part of the show? Like, was it collaborative or was it like separate?
It was a separate part of the show. Yeah, they did their yeah. they did their run. They were yeah. using the stage as a runway, and it was affiliated with Macy's, and then you know they were done, and then about an hour later we went on and played.
Oh, that is so fun. So did the girls stay to watch the show after?
Yes, they did. Yeah, they hung out. They were really excited to meet the Hansons. And, I mean, there was just a meet and greet on our bus. And then those girls from Atlanta started coming out to all the shows after that. And they got really close. So, yeah, they ended up getting married. Yep.
That's such a great story, Scott. I love that. So when we interview people for this podcast, there's sort of two overriding themes that always come up with people that knew them, particularly at this time. And I can't speak for later because I'm only in 97 at the moment. Like everyone I've interviewed has to do with this era. But people say the first thing is that Hanson are like genuinely lovely, lovely people. And the second thing that people talk to me about around this, like, you know, 97, 98 era, is that it was just the time of their lives. Like, it was just such a good time. It was so joyful. It was full of so many good experiences. Is that sort of what you would say is reflective of your time as well?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they were amazing people. They were really fun to work for. And they kept you laughing a lot. You know, Zach was always a big... he was a big Chris Farley fan, so there was always a Chris Farley quote or, you know, living in a van down by the river. That was like a big – that was said constantly, consistently throughout the rehearsal. So, yeah, so we'd be laughing a lot, you know. And, again, like their parents were just keeping them so grounded that and we – you know, it was a lot of really fun traveling. I got to go to a lot of places that I wouldn't have – been able to go, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was.
Were there any like bad time? Like, what's the worst part of doing this for a job?
I mean, I think I traveled so much that I got a little bit burnt out on, you know, I got a little bit burnt out on traveling. And when I came home, I just wanted to be home, you know, sleep in the same bed and, you know, you wake up with your own coffee maker sort of thing. And it took me a little while to want to go other places again. I think I needed to rebuild that love of traveling. I think there was one story. We were doing Christmas in Washington. And I think the band at that time was probably Jason Taylor on guitar. It might not have been Ravi. But we were leaving out of JFK and we were going to fly down to Washington, D.C. to play for the Clintons. And we were up in the air for about 20 minutes and both one of the engines went out and then the plane like slowly turned back around and then the other engine went out. So we were like kind of like, you know,
oh my God.
A little bit back and forth. And yeah, I mean, and it was interesting because people didn't really start panicking until they saw all the emergency vehicles on the runway. Like there was just all these different ambulances and police cars flooding the runway. And somehow the pilot, I don't know how he did it, but he managed to land it perfectly because it was, I mean, we were just kind of gliding at that point and somehow he managed to, the plane was rocking back and forth really wildly and he landed it perfectly. And it was kind of funny cause they were like, all right, now you got to get on another plane.
Oh.
and some of the people were like, no, we're going to take a van, you know?
Did it change? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so I mean, if I was going to say like the worst experience was, that was probably the strangest day with the whole thing. We ended up going down and playing. We took another flight and we ended up having a good gig. for that Christmas in Washington thing. This, you know, it was amazing to see how much security there is for, you know, the president. And, you know, that was pretty interesting. You know, people up in the rafters and stuff, and Secret Service all over the place.
How awesome. Just what an awesome experience, honestly, to get to see, not the plane, but to the White House, to get to see that and be a part of that. That is just incredible. I can't even imagine. So much. I get the burnt out thing too, and I've heard that there was a lot of like schedule changes as well, really last minute, that made it really tricky for you to be like, or have like ownership over your own time and space and things like that.
Yes.
And I think that can feed into that burnout and constant being on as well.
Yeah, there were a lot of schedule changes. Like we were, in 2000, I guess November was really cool. We went to South America for a month. And that was the end of the tour. I think we ended up in Brazil. But yeah, we did Mexico and Chile and Buenos Aires and Brazil. And then we were going to try to go to, they wanted to go to Japan and Hawaii, but I think everybody was so exhausted that they just cut that part out of the trip. But South America was great. It was really fun. My Spanish used to be a lot better than it is now. So they sort of saw that as respect to their culture. And I went out a lot and saw a lot of the cities. That was a really great time for me. That was really fun. That might've been one of my favorite times. Really interesting. The clubs there like didn't really open until like 11 or 12 at night.
Oh my goodness. What was the reception like in Brazil? Because Brazilian fans are known to be really, they love the band.
Yes.
Well, they're big fans. So did you notice a difference in reception, say, like to, I know it was wild everywhere, but was Brazil particularly wild?
South America was generally much wilder, yeah. Yeah, they were really big fans, and they would stay outside the hotel and scream Hanson all day long. it was really fun. And you know what? I still, you know, going back to the social media thing, I'm still able to keep in touch with some of those friends that I made during that time. And it's really nice. Brazil was really special. It's an amazing country, beautiful culture. The food is awesome. And the people were really nice. Yeah, they were, the fans all throughout South America were pretty intense and really cool, very cool people.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. So you mentioned that you're sort of going out, the clubs are opening around 11 midnight, but obviously, or maybe obviously not, what are Hanson doing? Like, I imagine, especially around 2000, maybe they're getting a little bit older, but at that 97, 98 point, what was happening after the show? Like, there's no huge after party, no one's hanging out drinking.
Yeah, there was none of that going on, yeah.
So what was sort of the general vibe after the shows, would you say?
It was, you know, that goes back to what Romeo was saying, was that, you know, he wanted them to enjoy that aspect of it a little bit more. It was a lot of Walker and Diana, you know, being more stable in their lives. It was a lot of family time. It was a very family oriented thing that was going on. You know, I had a little more freedom to go out and mingle. So it was, I mean, I really was proud of that moment when they came on the bus and they got to have that meet and greet. That was like kind of like a way of saying thank you, you know, because it was, you know, they're amazing people. And, you know, it's funny because like, I think Walker and Diana did save them from a lot of those pitfalls, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, especially in the music business, it's crazy. Like you can really, it's when there was a lot of free alcohol and you can really overindulge, you know. I haven't drank in 24 years and it was something that I really had to take a look at.
I've heard so many horror stories. I feel like everyone needs a Walker and Diana.
We are very cool people. Yes. Amazing. Yeah.
And I think you look at some like Justin Bieber and I know the younger people watch a lot of docos and so many parents don't have that wherewithal to hold it together. Yeah. They see the drugs and alcohol as well, right? And they see the money and suddenly there's all this available to them. And I think that that's always really tricky to see. So, yeah. I'm sure that they met, like, from what I sort of sense is to like, there's a little bit of loneliness because they are, and at this point, everyone knows who they are. They're not just, they can't walk down the street like that, you know,
yeah.
They're not having those normal social interactions. So I can imagine what you're saying about the bus, you know, how nice that would be to have some social interaction at that point.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is a little bit of loneliness that goes on with that. And, you know, like one time they were like, oh, do you want to go out to the movies with us? And it was like a van with tinted windows and they had to wear some disguises. And, you know, like one time we played at a Great Adventure down in Dallas and they closed down the entire Great Adventure for after hours. And the Hansons went on each, you know, they went on the rides by themselves, you know. So I think it involved a lot of that sort of stuff where, you know, kind of after hours and closing the place down. And it can be difficult. What they were going through could be really difficult at times. Yeah.
Yeah. I can understand that. So what happened around, so you went straight up until the year 2000 and then what sort of happened when did you stop working with the band?
It was 2001. They wanted me to find one of my friends that played guitar and keyboards. They were going to compress the band down to the three of them, bass and a guy that played keyboards and guitar, which I think is their lineup now, you know. That was their idea, you know, just because, you know, not as many people were, you know, they weren't filling the same size venues. So they wanted to compress the band a little bit. So I recommended one of my friends and he went in for an audition. And then I went in, it was in New York City. I think I hung out a couple times with them in New York City. I think they were living in New York at that time.
Yeah.
They had an apartment in Brooklyn or something, right? And
yeah.
We went in, we hung out, and Michelle Branch was a really good friend of theirs, and we all hung out at one of the really well-known diners in Manhattan, and her story was interesting. She was on the road a lot. I think she was really big at that time, and she was having a hard time finding somebody to watch her house while she was on the road. She was really cool, though. She had been a Hanson fan for a long time, and she had come out to a lot of shows. So I think they were friends for a very long time.
Yeah, we wonder sometimes if they were dating.
Oh, really?
And, like, sometimes there's a theory that Michelle Branch wrote a song about Taylor Hanson.
That's so really interesting. They were really close. They were very close friends. It's interesting because I met her and her band before she got big. So it must have been, it must have been 1999 or 2000 when she was coming to some of the shows. And I think she was coming.
Yeah,
maybe you know more about it than I do. I don't know.
No, that's all I know. So this is, it's interesting because it is, and it's always, when you get to this age too, it's always really hard to timeline things. And that's a big part of it. Trying to piece things together. Like, where were we? When did this happen?
Yeah, it's really funny because you reached out to me and I was like, wow, I better, You know, it's funny. I went through like, I went through to try to find my old tour schedules because I have the Albertine tour, and you know, I went through to find the, you know, I had to find the tour schedules. So yeah, I did end up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have like four schedules with a lot of the dates, but I mean, there's still a lot of stuff that's left out that. Some of the stuff you're still reminding me of, which is really cool.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I went to Montana Studios in New York to do the audition.
Yeah.
And I think they just wanted to move on to somebody else. It was actually, I really got lucky because like Walker called me on the phone and we had a really good conversation. And I sort of said, you know, thank you so much for, I got to thank him, which felt really good. And it sort of felt like I was almost a little bit relieved when he said they were just, I think what he said was they're just going to go out as a trio for the next stint of gigs. And I was sort of relieved, to be honest, because it was like certain, you know, bands have a certain timeline, you know, and, It sort of felt like it had, it was enough, like it had run its course sort of thing. And I was so grateful that like he called me and I was able to say thank you. I was able to say, listen, I'd be living in my parents' basement had I not done this gig. And I'm able to have a career in music because, you know, the Hanson thing got me in a good financial position to just, you know, it really helped out a lot. So it felt great to say thank you to them. And then I guess the last time I saw them was Diana was keeping in touch with my mother because my mother's really she's got an amazing personality and she's really outspoken and she's really charismatic. And they always really liked her. So Diana and my mother kept in touch. And they were playing at Starland Ballroom in New Jersey. Probably, I mean, it must have been 10 years, a little bit over 10 years ago. So we went down to see them. I went with my mother, and I got to thank them again in person, and it felt really good. And I was at that time I was on the road with a band called Bernie Worrell Orchestra. Bernie Worrell was a musician who had played with Parliament Funkadelic and the Talking Heads, and he was a genius. He passed a few years back in 2016, but I did that from 2011 to 2015, a lot of traveling and really fun shows with that. But yeah, it sort of felt like it felt, you know, it felt like it.
And I think to be, you talk about like sort of it running its course. It's almost like that quit while you're ahead thing too, because it was a pocket in time that you were so heavily involved with and in and to be a part of, but that moment didn't last. But to say that you were a part of the moment where it all broke and when everything was wild and those really initial things, I think is such an awesome memory to have. And like you're saying, to have that gratitude for that, you know, it's huge to be a part of something so prolific like that, which did run its course, you know.
I was really lucky to be a part of it. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I'm just glad that I was able to say thank you. And it was interesting because he was kind of, when Walker called, I think he was expecting me to be kind of upset, but I was actually just kind of appreciative of the time I'd spent with them and grateful for it. And I think it sort of caught him off guard in a way that was, it was a good feeling. You know, I mean, it wasn't a bad feeling. It wasn't a terrible thing. You know, it was kind of a nice thing, and it was a nice way, you know, it was a nice part, you know, a nice way to part.
Yeah, absolutely. So that 10 years ago is probably like the last time you got to check them out in concert.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm friends with some people that are still Hanson fans on Facebook and Instagram. And one of my friends is trying to get me to meet up with her at a show in Philadelphia. And if I have off, maybe I'll go down and do that. That would be really fun. Because it's been, yeah, it's been 10 years, so it's been a little while.
You should go. Everyone would love to see you, Scott, like, no doubt. And after listening to this, and I'll just put out there that, you know, I'm not surprised at the way that you spoke to Walker, because I've worked with a lot of people on this pod, and I've reached out to many different personalities, and you were always so kind and grateful and generous with your time as well. So I want to thank you for being so open and honest and putting your hand up in the way that you have. It's so appreciated.
Oh, thank you too. Yeah, I'm really, you know, I know this is a lot of work, and yeah, you've put in a lot of work. I mean, it was the variety of guests you've gotten too. You know, I've been checking it out, and you know, to get Steve Greenberg is really amazing. You know, that's a lot of work what you're doing, you know, and I hope it feels like, you know, you're doing a really good thing for a lot of people, because I mean, I'm sure there's going to be people all over the world that will listen to your podcast, you know. I think it's pretty cool. So it's gotta be worth it. I hope it feels like it's, you know, worth the time, because it seems like you're doing a lot of research for it.
Thank you. And thank you so much for that, because I never really thought too much about how much was going to go into it, but it's almost like a full-time job, because you're always sort of having to network. And then when you get someone, the level of research that you sort of have to do is a lot. And then, you know, teeing everything up. So, and then you edit, and then you get it out there, and social mediaing, like it is a lot.
It's a lot.
I appreciate
it. Yeah, I guess it definitely labor of love, you know, and, you know, I mean, it relates to what the music industry has kind of become lately, because, like, you know, I do recordings with friends. I have a little studio at my house, and we put so much time and effort into writing and recording and mixing and mastering. You know, you do it all yourself, and, you know, you put it out there, and you're doing it more because you know in your heart, like you would rather do that than do something else, you know?
Yeah. Exactly.
And you kind of,
exactly. And
you have a voice that you want to put out, and you have, you know, you have an idea that you want to do this. And I think it's a really cool thing. It does relate to the whole music thing, because, you know, you look at the streaming revenue that's coming in for some of the stuff you're doing, and it's like, you're not, you know, you're doing it because you want to do it and you love it, you know?
Yeah, I love that sentiment, and you're so right, because, yeah, I think that that comes with age too, right? Like, you want to be doing something that you're passionate about, and that it has to mean something nowadays. I think the older I get, I'm like, I can't, you know, any longer just do stuff for the sake of doing it. It's all got to sort of have that meaning, and when you have that, it doesn't really matter, you know, income wise or anything. It's just those little joyful pockets while we're still here, while we're still,
yeah,
here, you know.
And the process of like, you're discovering things and you're learning, and, you know, it's the discovery process while you're making it too, creating the thing. You have the original idea, and then the whole creation process is really fun. You know, I love, you know, I write on my, when I have the time. And I think it's a similar thing. And it's the whole creative process is really exciting. It's a nice little natural high that you get, and it's really fun.
I agree. So where can people find you? What's all your things? Have you got a website, social media handles? Where can people reach out to you if they so want?
Yeah, if they want to reach out to me, Nylon Scott on Instagram. I think, you know, you could probably just type in Scott Hogan too on Instagram. I'm on Facebook if you want to reach me there. I have a YouTube channel under Scott Hogan, or Scott Hogan Music for a website. I've been doing this kind of blending like Arabic music with you know, American jazz. I'm working with this guy that I went on the road with, Bernie Worrell with. He played percussion on those tours, and he plays percussion on The Lion King for maybe 20 years. a really good friend of mine, Glenn Fitton. So if you, you know, Glenn Fitton slash Scott Hogan, yeah, we're kind of like blending. He's got this really interesting way of playing, you know, all this different types of percussion. And we're kind of blending Middle Eastern music with American music. And it's been really fun.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. What a great idea. Well, everyone will reach out to you, I'm sure. Everyone will be very looking forward to seeing you in Philly when you go. So I'm going to tag you. You're not getting out of that one. I think it's a really good idea, and I think a lot of people would really like to see you. And probably, again, I have noticed in American fans particularly, they do know all of the people that toured with them in those very early days. So I'm sure if you went, it would be a really nice it would be a nice surprise for everyone. So
go. That sounds good. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Well, stay on the call. Don't hang up. But I'm hanging up. I'm pressing stop, but I'll talk to you in a second.
Thanks, Scott. Thank you.